You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja.
We love the earth.
It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Monday, July 17th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. We've got an amazing show for you today, and we've reorganized things just a little bit. You're going to hear the cannabis headline news immediately after this introduction. We're going to get right to the news, and then after the news, we've got ACES patient-focused update. That's right, Americans for Safe Access's Chief Science Officer, Dr. Jehan Marku, PhD, and David Mangone, one of their policy analysts, will be joining us to discuss the latest bills moving through Congress that will be of benefit to medical cannabis patients. Also, a look at the need for cannabis lab certification. That's coming up on the patient-focused update. Then we're going to welcome back a segment here to the Marijuana Agenda. Our anti-drug public service announcement of the day will be happening. Then we'll get to our drug war data mining, where Drug Policy Alliance has released a style guide for lawmakers to discuss drug policy reform issues. In our Northeast Cannabis Chronicle, we've got a Rhode Island Marijuana Study Commission being boycotted by marijuana reformers, including Regulate Rhode Island. Jared Moffitt from the group joins us to discuss why. And then in the Radical Rant, we'll show you how Jeff Sessions, our Attorney General, wants to increase asset forfeiture and throw us right back to the Just Say No 1980s.
This is your Cannabis Headline News. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your Cannabis Headline News for Monday, July 17th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. Drug-sniffing police dogs in Colorado may need new training if they can detect marijuana after a ruling last week by the Colorado Court of Appeals that sets a new precedent for drug cases. A three-judge panel agreed that if a drug-sniffing dog is trained to alert officers to marijuana and other drugs, cops need more cause to search a vehicle without permission. The decision came out of a 2015 case in Moffitt County where a drug-sniffing dog named Kilo alerted officers to the presence of an illegal drug in a truck driven by Craig resident Kevin McKnight, the Grand Junction Sentinel reported. But because Kilo could not tell officers whether he smelled pot or other drugs, the search was illegal, judges wrote. The dog was trained to identify cocaine, heroin, ecstasy, methamphetamine, and marijuana. Marijuana possession by adults over 21 is legal in Colorado. The smell of marijuana in a Colorado search is still sufficient if there are other factors that raise an officer's suspicion. Colorado Supreme Court ruled in 2016 that a drug dog smell test can contribute to a probable cause determination if the suspects are doing something else to raise suspicion. Massachusetts House and Senate negotiators reached an agreement Monday on the state's voter-approved marijuana law that would allow retail pot sales to be taxed at a maximum 20% rate, according to a report by the Associated Press. Highlights of the deal were revealed by a six-member conference committee that spent several weeks trying to resolve differences between the two chambers. The compromise language mostly splits the difference between a House proposal to raise the total tax on marijuana to a mandatory 28% and the Senate version of the bill, which called for keeping the tax at a maximum of 12%. Lawmakers also compromised on the dispute over local control of pot shops. In cities and towns where voters backed the November ballot question, a referendum would be required to ban or restrict retail marijuana stores. But in communities where a majority of residents voted against the ballot question, pot shops could be barred by a simple vote of the board of the selectmen or city council. At the Alaska Marijuana Control Board's meeting held Wednesday through Friday this week in Fairbanks, board members approved 3-2 a proposal to set up rules for on-site marijuana consumption at retail stores. The proposal includes a draft of specific rules for everything from ventilation and location of these consumption areas to how much marijuana can be used there and much more. Citizens will have 60 days to comment on the proposal before the draft rules come back to the board, likely at the November meeting. In November 2015, the board voted to allow on-site consumption at marijuana stores. Alaska Dispatch News reported at the time that the amendment passed to allow such consumption would function as a placeholder, pending more specific rules. In February, Alaska Dispatch News reported the board abandoned a regulatory project that had been in the works since May 2016. But then, in March, the body decided it would take another stab at it. Alaska's set of regulations for on-site marijuana consumption would appear to be one of the first, if not the first, in the country. Pacific Daily News reports that Guam Governor Eddie Calvo last Friday signed a new law authorizing the Department of Revenue and Taxation to begin issuing business licenses for the island's medical marijuana program. The marijuana program remains stalled for other reasons, however. Under the new law, Revenue Tax can issue $1,000 licenses for businesses that intend to cultivate, manufacture, lab test, and dispense marijuana. The measure was addressing an oversight in the law that authorized the implementation of Guam's medical marijuana program back in 2014, but failed to authorize any department to issue the licenses. Congressman Bill Foster, a Democrat from Illinois, reintroduced legislation to change penalties students face when convicted of minor marijuana offenses. The Second Chance for Students Act would allow students convicted of an offense involving the possession of marijuana to retain financial aid eligibility for 6 months while they complete a drug rehabilitation program. Under current policy, students convicted of drug offenses lose eligibility for federal financial aid for a period of time. For many students, financial aid can mean the difference between staying in school and dropping out. Research indicates that once a student leaves school, they have a significantly lower chance of completing a degree. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Monday, July 17th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Please help support my independent cannabis radio journalism by becoming a patron of the Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to mjagenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. For your $4.20 monthly donation, you'll keep our free live YouTube show on the air and receive your own private podcast feed of the first hour. For just $9.99, you'll receive both hours of the show and special downloads only available for VIPs. Thank you for your support.
The Marijuana Agenda. Kevin Sabet's boogeyman since 2012.
You have offended my family, and you have offended Shaman Temple.
Yes, might have gotten away with it too. If it wasn't for these blasted kids and their dogs.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal potland Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House. Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com, City of Portland, permit number 17-159855. Welcome to ACE's Patient Focused Update. Almost every U.S. state now recognizes some form of cannabis as medicine. But since 1971, the federal government has steadfastly denied the medical benefits of herbal cannabis. Americans for Safe Access is the nation's leading organization fighting for the rights of all patients who use cannabis as medicine. Join us now for another edition of ACE's Patient Focused Update. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of ACE's Patient Focused Update, brought to you by Americans for Safe Access, the nation's leading organization fighting for the right for all people to access cannabis as a safe and effective medicine. Joining us here to talk about the latest developments in medical cannabis, we have Jehan Marku, who's the Chief Science Officer for Americans for Safe Access, and David Mangone, who's the Legislative Analyst for the organization. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You know, it's a pretty momentous day with respect to medical cannabis developments in that there is an amendment that's been passed that will possibly lead to our nation's veterans being able to access medical cannabis. We'll bring that up at the end of our interview with the legislative analyst, David Mangone. Let's start with Dr. Marcoux, because we've been discussing on the last episode the patient-focused certification project that you guys are engaged in. And the latest news that we heard was that this has gotten picked up by a major American university. So, Dr. Marcoux, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So starting on June 22nd, ACES Patient Focus Certification Training Program unveiled its new training platform, which was developed with the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. And so there is a partnership between PFC and the University Center for Innovative Pharmacy Solutions. And this will be the first training program for cannabis offered through a university and accredited. This partnership will extend the reach of the PFC training program by making courses available through the university's online platform at www.pfctraining.org. This story has received a lot of coverage in the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, and a lot of local publications in Maryland. And people are really excited about this because this promotes medication safety through training, and ultimately educates healthcare providers on the considerations of medical cannabis in treatment decisions. These certified training courses cover best practices, regulatory guidelines for cultivators, manufacturers, dispensaries, and labs. Regulators, operators, and industry workers can enroll in the program to learn how to comply with state regulations and best practices. So we are in the process of getting accreditation. It will be available by August 15th. The University School of Maryland was founded in 1841 and has a 175-year history of pharmacy education. ASA brings 15 years of hands-on expertise in developing and implementing medical cannabis laws, regulations, and training.
Wow, what an amazing development. Is this the first time that we've had a major American university that has partnered up with a reform organization like ASA?
There have been smaller universities that have developed their own programs. At Temple University, they teach the medical students about cannabis. It's like, a couple hours as part of their curriculum, teaching about the endocannabinoid system. Vermont has a program, but this is the first time that a national effort has been made between a medical cannabis organization and a university, like you said. But the thing that's interesting here is it's not just localized. This is intended for anyone in the United States and U.S. territories to take the training so they can comply with state regulations. And I think that that is truly one of the unique things, is that not only is it partnered with a university, but it's also designed to adapt to meet regulatory requirements in any jurisdiction.
Fantastic. And another aspect of the patient-focused certification that I think is important is with laboratories. This has become a big issue here in my home state of Oregon, where patients are in need of medicine that is safe and tested and free from contaminants. So what is ASA doing with the PFC in regard to labs?
Thank you, Russ. That's a great question. Actually, today, July 13th, we are offering our certification program and its assessment services free for laboratories as part of an effort to help address the opioid epidemic. That is, PFC is offering free medical cannabis laboratory assessments in an effort to decrease opioid use and associated fatalities. So it's no secret, across the nation, opioid-related deaths and fatalities are decreasing in states that have medical cannabis programs. But the benefits are limited due to a lack of accurately labeled and tested products. And so we're announcing that we're going to begin offering free assessment and certification services for cannabis testing laboratories to help increase the number of safe and standardized medical products in an effort to help combat the opioid epidemic. I spoke with Jeffrey Raber, who runs the workshop laboratory, and was also the president of the Association of Commercial Cannabis Labs. And he told me this morning that laboratories play a vital role in the standardization and quality assurance of medical cannabis products, and providing cannabis as a medicine can positively impact the opioid epidemic because you can offer an alternative for patients to manage pain in a physiologically safer manner. And so basically the idea is, in if we have more accurately tested products, that means more cannabis is going to be available for patients, and there'll be more patients who can choose that as an option instead of opioids. You know, over the last 15 years, the use of opioids has soared by over 500%, and the overdose rate has nearly quadrupled. And again, research has demonstrated a reduction in opioid use and associated overdoses in states with medical cannabis programs. And so if we want to leverage this relationship between medical cannabis laws and opioid overdose mortality, then I think one way to move the industry towards realizing those benefits on public health is to get the laboratories certified, get them accredited. Because I think one of the barriers here is that laboratories oftentimes can lack the financial resources needed to access these third-party assessments, these certification services, which are often necessary to ensure the accurate testing results. And so, you know, our hope is that this will be one thing that PFC can do, one to, you know, make sure patients have accurately tested medicine and really make a bigger impact on the opioid statistics.
You know, a lot of the information that we have on these surveys showing the decline in opiate-related harms in the medical cannabis states is really in its infancy. I mean, we've had medical cannabis since 1996 in California and less time, but in more states, up to 29 now. But it seems like few, if any, of these states are actually surveying the patients, trying to find out what's really working. So we know that the access to medical cannabis is going to help with respect to the opiate crisis. But do you think that by certifying these labs and getting more accurate information about the specific types of cannabis, that maybe we get more detail? We find that certain strains or certain conditions are treated better by, you know, certain types of medicine?
Absolutely. You know, we all want to see that customization, that pharmacogenomic approach where we can match a strain to a specific patient population, subpopulation, or even individual. And I think that the first step is getting as much information as we can about the plant. You know, I don't think much people argue about whether or not it's an effective medicine. Right now we're trying to sort of enhance its ability, you know, sort of kind of like the entourage effect. How do we best utilize this so that people continue to have positive impacts, that we continue to see these benefits? And accurate lab results are really important. You know, I believe that laboratories are the cradle of cannabis safety. That's where it comes from, and that's where we're going to get the most information, I think, about the plant.
Another set of patients who are in desperate need of cannabis medicine would be our nation's veterans, many of whom suffer from traumatic brain injuries, from post-traumatic stress, and other conditions that are eminently treatable with medical cannabis. Today, which we're pre-recording this on Thursday, July 13th, there was a significant development in the Congress with respect to gaining access for our nation's veterans. And joining us to discuss that is David Mangone again, our legislative analyst from Americans for Safe Access. David, can you tell our listeners what transpired today that is so hopeful for our nation's vets?
Sure. This morning, there was a pretty significant development as far as access to cannabis for veterans. The Senate Appropriations Committee passed an amendment that allows Veterans Affairs patients and Veterans Administration's patients in states with medical cannabis programs to discuss medical cannabis with their doctors. The amendment passed by a vote of 24-7 with 15 Democrats, which is all 15 Democrats on the committee, and 9 Republicans, which is 9 out of the 16 on the committee. This was a significantly bigger margin than last year. Last year's vote was a vote of 20-10. And what this really does is it allows patients to have the option to discuss with their VA providers the option of medical cannabis. In 2016, the VA had issued a policy directive which had prohibited their physicians and their healthcare providers from discussing cannabis with veterans. But in light of recent developments, particularly from the American Legion coming out in support of more research for cannabis, as well as the Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin indicating that he supports further research and the possible benefits of medical cannabis, this is a tremendous win for our nation's veterans.
And of course, we've been working on this for years now to try to gain this access. What are the next steps? And are you hopeful that we can clear these hurdles and finally get our vets some medicine?
Well, sure. The appropriations process and the budget process is always something that lasts longer than just one hearing or one amendment. This amendment will be included in the Veterans Appropriations Bill that will be voted on finally by the full Senate and the House of Representatives, and they'll probably have a conference committee. Unfortunately, last year, at the last moment, this amendment was stripped out of the bill text, but based on the new support of this amendment, we're hopeful that it will remain in the final bill text and veterans will be able to access the care they need and they deserve. But as I said, it's far from over. There's still a lot more work that needs to be done, both for veterans and for cannabis patients who have not served in the armed forces. But this is a great first step, and it's a really great victory for Americans' veterans who need medical cannabis.
David, tell our listeners who might be veterans or might just be advocates and want to help out where they can get more information and how they can push this fight forward.
Well, I would start with seeing where your congressman and your senator stands on the issue. If they're friendly, that doesn't mean you should not contact them. Contact them and thank them for their efforts. Thank them for their continued support and make sure that they're aware of how important this amendment is to either you as a veteran or you as a community member who wants to assist the veterans of our country. On the other hand, if you're a member of Congress or your senator has been publicly opposed to medical cannabis or hasn't taken a position, I think now is a great time to call their office and write letters and show how important this issue is to you and how important this issue is to our country and those who have served.
Well, thank you, David, for that and giving us this update. And Dr. Marku, before we wrap things up, anything else you'd like to tell our listeners as far as contacts, more information, or other subjects?
Yes, I'd like to say that all of our reports are available at safeaccessnow.org/reports. And so if you want to download any of our recent information about regulating cannabis, analysis of the patchwork of state programs, and if laboratories want to apply for this assessment certification program, patientfocusedcertification.org, click on the bright red button that says apply, and we'll get back to you right away. So those would be the two main links I'd say today. David, do you have any other resources you'd want to add?
I will add that in today's political climate, with the Department of Justice being what seems to be a significant roadblock to access to medical cannabis, it's important to stay aware of what's happening in the federal government, what's happening in the executive branch, and not to take protections that have existed in the past for granted.
Dr. Jan Marku and David Mangone, thank you so much for joining us today on ACE's Patient Focused Update.
Thank you, Russ. Talk to you in 2 weeks.
Thank you, Russ.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the conservative agenda, minus the hypocrisy.
I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda.
join me for A Sensible Future from Students for Sensible Drug Policy every other Tuesday here on the Marijuana Agenda. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about. Now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement. And now, in the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Marijuana Agenda presents this anti-drug public service announcement.
Some people start slumming as a social thing, you know? I probably wouldn't do it by myself.
That was mine.
Slumming stands for sticking leeches on myself.
Leeches?
Yeah, leeches.
I don't get it. I've had to confiscate all this. It's a problem.
It's like you hear people talking about slumming over the weekend.
It's hard not to get into it.
To combat this sort of reefer madness, listen to the Marijuana Agenda every weekday at mjagenda.com.
Promoting the end of adult cannabis prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It's even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more on this edition of Drug War Data Mining.
Today in the Data Mines, we take a look at a new white paper that's been released by the Drug Policy Alliance, and it's called Talking About Drug Use, a Glossary for Elected Officials. The idea behind this paper is to give people an idea on how to better frame the issues of drug reform and drug dependence in stories and in press releases when we're talking about drug reform issues. It was developed in partnership with the Peer Network of New York. They specialize in services for health education, testing for HIV and Hep C, harm reduction guidance, recovering coaching, and community outreach. And the basics behind this is to encourage our lawmakers, and I would argue this should go out to our journalists as well, to not use dehumanizing, demeaning, or demoralizing language. Instead, to replace that with people-first language that confers dignity and respect. So some of the ideas, some of the examples they give here are very instructive. For example, let's refrain from calling people an addict or a fiend, a dope fiend. We want to distinguish between problematic use and personal use instead. We want to say a person who uses drugs or a person who has a problematic relationship with drugs, if indeed they do. When you say someone's an addict or a fiend, you're automatically demonizing them and you aren't distinguishing whether someone's just a drug user or whether someone has a problem with their use. They also advise against using the terms get clean or to have a clean drug test. The use clean has an implication behind it that the person who uses drugs is dirty. So instead, we could say a person who formerly used drugs instead of someone who's clean, or a test was negative or a test was not positive for a particular substance rather than saying clean. Obvious terms like junkie, crackhead, zombie, tweaker, those kind of terms, obviously dehumanizing terms for people who use various substances, leads to stigma, leads to discrimination. So instead, we want to refer to a person who uses whatever drug, a person who uses meth, a person who uses heroin, a person who uses synthetic cannabinoids, even if that's the case where you have to specify, we don't even necessarily have to specify what drug someone might be using in some stories. Don't try to divide people in our discussions. Don't say those people, those drug users. Inclusive language, people first language is what we're looking for. We also don't want to refer to someone behaving crazy. They'd overdosed on synthetic cannabinoids and they were crazy. Well, crazy is a derogatory term for mental illness. And you're not a psychiatrist in most cases. You're not a psychologist, not someone who could actually diagnose someone who's behaving in a strange manner. Refer to them, the behavior is strange, sure, but crazy is a judgment call. The term crack baby needs to be eliminated from all of our vocabularies. First of all, it's not true. This was a huge scare throughout the 1980s, this idea that women who had babies exposed to crack cocaine in utero would turn out badly. That is not the case. Numerous studies have followed up on this. They found that it was parental poverty has more of an impact on these kids than any of the cocaine they were exposed to in utero. We can refer to kids that are, exposed to drugs in utero, just say it that way, prenatal exposure to drugs, or however it should be referred to. We don't want to refer to people poisoning themselves. You're not poisoning yourself. That, again, is a judgment sort of call. And most people taking drugs don't poison themselves. They don't kill themselves with their drugs. Any sort of statement that something is the crack of something, it's the new crack of this, it's the crack of marijuana, again, that's fear-mongering, that's demonization, and it just leads to more criminalization. The term synthetic marijuana, I'm so happy that DPA included this. Synthetic marijuana is an inaccurate term that perpetuates the myth that novel substances such as K2 and spice are like marijuana, when synthetic cannabinoids actually have quite different and more powerful effects than marijuana. Saying synthetic marijuana too easily draws natural marijuana into this frame of something that's being dangerous and out of control. Instead, we want to go with synthetic cannabinoids. And we don't want to refer to people who were in prison as offenders or inmates or ex-cons. A formerly incarcerated person, a person who used to be in prison, a person who has completed their sentence. These are better ways to refer to that sort of situation. And we don't want to draw distinctions on the way people are using drugs, sniffing, injecting, these arbitrary when it comes to how a person has a problem. You know, when you say someone's injecting drugs, people have this, they conjures up in people's mind that someone's far more addicted than someone who's snorting or smoking or even drinking in the case of alcohol. Addiction can happen and problematic use of drugs can happen regardless of the method by which you use those drugs. So it's unnecessary to specify how those drugs are being used, except maybe in a case when you're talking about the spread of diseases through infected needles, then it might be necessary to refer to that. And finally, the idea of trying to crack down on a supply. The term crackdown itself, again, brings back the idea of punitive criminal punishment, criminalization, prohibition. And these supplies or these strategies have failed to control the supply of marijuana in any sort of way, or any other drug for that matter. It's available at drugpolicy.org. I'll provide the link in our chat room and on our post at mjagenda.com.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. If you're a cannabis brand looking to build trust and awareness within the community, consider becoming a sponsor of this program. Your message will be seen and heard by the most dedicated followers of marijuana policy reform, who are loyal and supportive of those brands that give back to the community. Just log on to mjagenda.com and click the Become a Patron button to learn how your brand can also be featured in my live nationwide appearances. Thank you for your support.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the liberal agenda, but with profits. Ka-ching.
This November, whether you see the words medical marijuana on your ballot or not, the issue is there. From the halls of Congress to your state capitol or city hall, politicians are already making decisions on medical marijuana policy on your behalf. This election, make sure they are representing you. Every vote is a vote for medical marijuana.
Visit votemedicalmarijuana.org today.
We'll be right back.
Welcome to the Northeast Cannabis Chronicle. Today, we catch you up on the latest news and speak with an expert from the Northeast region of the United States. From New England to the Mid-Atlantic, including the evolution of consumer cannabis in Massachusetts and Maine. Now, let's return to the birthplace of our nation in this edition of the Northeast Cannabis Chronicle.
Welcome to the Northeast Cannabis Chronicle. I'm Russ Belville, and as we continue taking a look at the progress of marijuana law reform in the northeastern states in the United States, we take a look at the smallest one, the state of Rhode Island, where Jared Moffitt is joining us from Regulate Rhode Island to discuss the situation. Jared, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, we're really excited about the prospects of passing legalization in the state of Rhode Island. It's long been looked at as a state that could do so through the legislative process. And I've been paying attention out here from the West Coast, and things seem to be going pretty well with the legislature putting together a legalization plan. But now there's been kind of an update on this that makes things seem like they're not going as well as I might have thought. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about this latest development you sent out in your press release?
Sure. So, well, in just a little bit more context, you know, we started the legislative session really strong. I mean, we had a new poll out showing, you know, nearly 60% of voters in the state, backing our efforts for legalization. When our sponsors introduced the legalization bill in the House, we got 25 co-sponsors out of a total of 75. So one in three House members were on our side, and had an even bigger proportion in the Senate. And, so in the face of sort of that, pretty significant legislative and public support, the leadership of both chambers basically just sort of ignored all that and gave the issue pretty minimal attention. We just had one hearing in the House, one hearing in the Senate, I'm happy that a few of the members really stuck through and listened to us the whole time, but a lot of the members, weren't even there. And now they're saying they want more time to study the issue. And so we're a little confused because, if you wanted to study the issue, why wasn't it studied at the committee hearings? Why weren't there more hearings? Why wasn't there more attention paid to the issue? So, I think the people, in our coalition and the supporters that we have across the state are very frustrated with the process. And, I don't blame the rank and file legislators in the state because, frankly, most of them that we've talked to, they want to vote on this. They think it's time to have a vote. It's been 7 years that a bill like this has been introduced. It's really the leadership of both chambers. It's the way that the process is a very top-down, leadership-heavy involved process. And for whatever reason, and we never really got a good explanation, the leadership decided they didn't want to hold a vote on our issue this year. So, in response, we basically said, you haven't listened to us. You've shown no interest in working with us. So we don't want to be a part of this, flawed study commission that you guys are proposing because it's a joke. The language in this study commission bill talks about what it's supposed to do, and it mentions Colorado and Washington as states that they're supposed to study, but they didn't even, take the effort to write out the other six states that have legalized marijuana. So if it's a really, if it's supposed to be a good faith effort to analyze the issue, and you can't even take the time to list all the states that have legalized marijuana and include that as part of the study, I mean, we're just not buying it. We think this is basically a joke. So that's why we're not participating.
This is it really does sound like one of these kick the can down the road sort of situations. And in other states that I've covered, it's always been pressure from law enforcement or drug reform, drug rehab groups or pharmaceutical groups somehow. But you don't find any particular pressures. You don't have any idea what might be causing this reticence from the leadership?
We really have no good idea because, what's been said publicly by the speaker is, we didn't see much support from the legislators, from the members of the House. And I find that hard to believe given that, again, our legislation had 25 co-sponsors. The study commission bill only had 18 co-sponsors. So I'm not sure why the study commission bill was allowed to get a vote and move forward, but our issue wasn't. So, I suspect that, what's really going on is perhaps that, the speaker, the leadership in the House, really doesn't like our issue for whatever reason. I mean, I know he's pretty conservative on a lot of other issues. He just doesn't want to say that publicly because he knows, that there's a cost to that. And so I think he's trying to play both sides and That's why they put up the study commission bill, because it was an easy out. It's a way, it's an excuse to not vote on the issue this year. And, you know, he wanted us to go along with that, and we said no thanks.
Oh, wow. All right. So it boggles the mind trying to figure out what else might need to be studied about marijuana legalization, given that it's been 5 years in play in Colorado and Washington, 3 years in play in Oregon and Alaska. You got four other states that have voted on this. Massachusetts and Maine have passed it. I can't imagine what they're holding this up for any legitimate reason. It does sound like it's a kick the can down the road thing. What is it that you're proposing? Are you proposing something that's way out of bounds compared to any of the other legalization states?
Not at all. I think our proposal at the beginning of the session was very reasonable. You know, we support home grow, but we knew that was an issue that the legislature had concerns about. So, you know, we decided to compromise a little bit and have a pretty low limit for home growing, and that was a big concession. We, you know, agreed to go along with some pretty strict regulations and things that, you know, that folks in the legislature and regulators had said that they wanted, and, you know, we went along with that. And now what we've done in the past few weeks is we've introduced an even more watered-down compromise proposal that's basically modeled on what the Vermont legislature did. So to legalize possession on July 1st, 2018, and then set up an advisory board of just six people to study how the regulatory system should be set up so that if the General Assembly wants to move forward next year, they already have recommendations for what to do. That's an extremely watered down legalization compromise, and they haven't wanted to even look at that. The speaker said there's not enough time to look at it, even though, you know, it's a very, very simple proposal. So, you know, for whatever reason, we've basically gotten the cold shoulder, and you know, I think we're going to continue fighting in the Senate, and I think that we have at least some shot of getting a little bit better results in the Senate. But you mentioned the other states too. What's really bizarre about this proposal to study is, of course, stores are going to be opening in Massachusetts next year in July, and so, you know, one of the arguments we've been consistently making is, what are you really accomplishing by delaying this? Rhode Islanders are going to have access to legal marijuana next year anyway. So, you know, most Rhode Islanders live within about a 10 to 15 minute drive of the border. So what are you really accomplishing? I mean, it seems like all they're doing is, you know, taking an opportunity to create jobs and bring new business investment to the state, create some tax revenue. And they're just saying, no, we'd rather all that go to Massachusetts. So, you know, it's really hard to wrap my head around what's going on in their heads. So we're kind of at a loss.
Yeah, that's amazing. And one other aspect of this that caught my eye, the reform movements on the East Coast, especially when we saw the legalization campaign in Washington, D.C., concentrated a lot on the racial disparities and the racial justice issue of marijuana legalization. I see in your press release that the president of the NAACP and the director from Direct Action for Rights and Equality, two groups that are fighting those racial justice issues, have joined your side. Is there anything else you can tell us about that angle and how racial justice is playing into this campaign?
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely a big, big part of it. It's, you know, a lot of our coalition members and advocates that we work with, you know, that's their top issue. And, you know, speaking for me personally, it's why I got involved with drug policy in the first place, was the, you know, sort of the racial injustice, the social injustice surrounding it all. So I think that's a big motivator. And, you know, I'm happy that our coalition partners agreed with us that this wasn't a legitimate process and decided to sort of stand in solidarity. But yeah, I mean, you know, thousands of Rhode Islanders have criminal records for low-level marijuana offenses, and it's done enormous damage to our communities. And, you know, of course, there's the racial, disparate rates of arrest that we've seen. So, you know, I think a lot of people are really scratching their head. This is a win for social justice. It's a win for, you know, the economy. It's a win for just common sense. It's a win for, you know, sort of libertarian values. So there's so many sort of interest groups that are part of our coalition, you know, that, again, it's just sort of baffling why we weren't able to get more consideration from the House leadership. Mm.
What are the current penalties in the state of Rhode Island for simple possession of marijuana?
So possession of less than an ounce is decriminalized. It's basically a $150 fine. But of course, you know, it's still, you know, illegal and a crime to buy it and sell it. So, We're obviously happy that possession is no longer a criminal offense, at least for less than an ounce. But we know that arrests are still happening. People that have over an ounce, people that are caught selling low levels, that's still an arrestable offense. And we see from 2013 and 2014, which is the most recent data that I've been able to find, there were about 1,400 arrests in Rhode Island from those 2 years, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but again, you've got to consider the fact that these people now have criminal records, that it's going to make it, more difficult to get jobs, more difficult to get housing. And, a lot of people are talking about criminal justice reform in the state, and we think this, sort of dovetails with that.
One other difference I can point out between East Coast and West Coast legalization reform is out here on the West Coast, we've had seriously entrenched medical marijuana interests that have sometimes spoken out against legalization, even going so far as campaigning against it. But I see in your press release a statement from the Rhode Island a spokesperson for Doctors for Cannabis Regulation, who's on your side as far as backing out of this this study commission. So what is the state of play between the medical side and the hope for recreational legalization in Rhode Island? Is there a conflict, or do the two sides seem to be working together?
I think largely we're working together, and I think that the solidarity increased a lot this year. We saw the head of the Rhode Island Patient Advocacy Coalition, Joanne Lepinen, testify in support of our bill. And, I think the motivation for that is there's been a lot of changes to the medical marijuana program in the past couple of years that have made it, more expensive and more onerous to be a medical marijuana patient. Essentially, I think, unfortunately, the state has begun to look more and more at medical marijuana as a revenue source. And, obviously, we don't think that's the right way to go. We think people that use it as medicine shouldn't be taxed. And so I think that they see that by legalizing it for everyone, that opens up that revenue from folks that just use it for fun, which we don't have a big issue with, and takes the pressure off them. And not only that, it removes a lot of the barriers to access that patients confront. So, I think it's a win because we're going to be increasing access for folks that need it for medical use. And, I think that we definitely stand together on that. So they have concerns about making sure that, when there is a legal market, that there's not a scarcity of supply for medical marijuana, which of course is a very important thing to worry about and to address. But overall, they do support what we're doing, and they think it could benefit people who need it for medical reasons.
That's fantastic news. Jared Moffitt is the director of Regulate Rhode Island, working to reform marijuana laws out there in the Ocean State. And Jared, do you have any contact information for our listeners if they want to learn more or help you out?
Sure. Yeah, you can, definitely check out our website, regulateri.com. We're on Facebook, just RegulateRI. If folks want to get in touch with me, you can find my phone number and email address on the website. It's just info@regulateri.com. And, my phone number's on there as well. So, happy to touch base with anyone that wants to learn more.
Thanks so much, Jared, for the work you're doing, and good luck in the state of Rhode Island.
Appreciate it, Russ. Thanks a lot.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is proudly sponsored by the Marijuana Business Association. The MJBA, called by NBC News the Cannabis Chamber of Commerce, is the fastest growing business association and the fastest growing industry in America. I've been working with the MJBA for years, and I personally invite you to join the MJBA. MJBA also publishes the popular MJ Headline News on Facebook and the MJNewsNetwork.com and Marijuana Channel 1 on YouTube. Visit MJBA.net for more details.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm Russ Belville with the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 2 weeks for the Marijuana Policy Insider with Marijuana Policy Project.
Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to legalize.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
Well, you know how last week we reported on Attorney General Keebler-Gump and his call for bringing back the Drug Abuse Resistance Education, better known infamously as DARE? Well, it's not the only 1980s Just Say No drug war relic he wants to bring back into the 21st century. We got a new report in the Washington Post by Christopher Ingraham at the Wonk blog. Jeff Sessions wants police to take more cash from American citizens. Longtime listeners of the show know exactly what I'm talking about. Civil asset forfeiture, the ability for cops to steal from you and me just because they say they smell weed. In his prepared remarks for a speech at the National District Attorneys Association in Minneapolis on Monday, he said, quote,
"We hope to issue this week a new directive on asset forfeiture, especially for drug traffickers. With care and professionalism, we plan to develop policies to increase forfeitures. No criminal should be allowed to keep the proceeds of their crime. Adoptive forfeitures are appropriate, as is sharing with our partners." End quote.
So let me unpack a little bit of this for you, right? First of all, we all understand what civil asset forfeiture is. It is the ability of cops to charge your property with a crime. Literally, the cases are like the United States of America versus $813,475.76 in cash. That could be an actual case. The United States of America versus a 2016 Lamborghini. That could be a case, right? The property itself is considered to be the ill-gotten gains of criminal activity. Now, here's the catch. In most states, you don't have to prove that it was a crime was committed. They just have to allege that this was ill-gotten proceeds, and then your stuff is guilty until proven innocent. You got to go to court to prove your stuff was not ill-gotten gains from criminal activity. Now, at the state level, there's been some good reforms on this. At the state level, I think it's 13 states now have passed laws that say, no, look, you got to get a criminal conviction before you take someone's stuff for a crime, right? Now, if you do find someone who's trafficking cocaine and you convict them of that, then you can take their yacht, then you can take their Lamborghini and so forth. And so when Sessions here is saying no criminal should be allowed to keep the proceeds of their crime, he's talking about something different. There's a thing called criminal asset forfeiture. When you're convicted of a crime, you lose your assets. Criminals aren't getting to keep their assets. He is throwing a smoke bomb in the middle of that discussion there by bringing up no criminal should, implying that criminals are keeping the proceeds. They are not. What he's referring to are cases where crimes haven't been proven, but prosecutors have a hunch. Sheriff's got a hunch. Somebody's a no good drug user, and they're not being able to seize that forfeiture stuff. Like I said, 13 states have passed laws now that have clamped down on this, that have made sure that the criminal conviction is required. Of course, at the federal level, no such reforms have happened, except for the Attorney General, the last one, Attorney General Holder, before Lynch, I should say, issuing some memoranda that limited the application of that asset forfeiture and bringing down the number of cases where asset forfeiture would be used. Of course, anything that the black people in the previous administration did has to be completely erased. So Sessions is against that Holder directive. Now, what's going on here? In a couple of these things that he mentioned, he said no criminal should be allowed to keep the proceeds of their crime. Adoptive forfeitures are appropriate, as is sharing with our partners. So he's talking about two things here: adoptive forfeitures and equitable sharing. Now, the equitable sharing part is part of the big controversy with asset forfeiture. Equitable sharing says when the cops seize this property, they get to keep some of it or most of it. And people have pointed out this brings up a policing for profit sort of corruption that we've got numerous cases that have shown cops going after people, specifically trying to get their land, trying to get their cash, trying to get their assets, and not necessarily trying to protect the public safety. So we already got that, the policing for profit through this equitable sharing program. And equitable sharing works hand in hand with something called adoptive forfeiture. What adoptive forfeiture is when the local cops, be they state cops, county sheriffs, local police, make a bust and want to seize assets, sometimes they're handcuffed from doing so by state law. Like I mentioned, 13 states have already said you got to have a criminal conviction. Other states have some pretty high bars to clear, between probable cause, reasonable suspicion, so forth, before you can start seizing assets. So what this adoptive forfeiture is the local cops saying, oh, hey, we can't seize any of this stuff. Let's turn this case over to the feds. Let's give this case to Jeff Sessions in the Department of Justice, because drugs are just as illegal at the federal level as they are at the state level, sometimes more so. Let's give that case to the feds. The feds then can use the asset forfeiture to get the stuff, and then through equitable sharing, they kick down a portion to the local cops. That's right. The local cops, state, county, and local cops have a incentive program to turn their cases over to the feds when their state is cracked down on the use of this asset forfeiture, turn the case over to the feds so the feds can use federal asset forfeiture and then take the results of that, the money, the assets, and turn portions of it back over to the state and local cops. Now, this, of course, goes right around the idea of local control. That's what we're always supposed to be hearing from conservatives in government, right? The state's rights. The state has the right to make the decisions. The federal government shouldn't be butting in on the states, shouldn't be using federal authority. Well, this is the perfect example of that. It's amazing how much these conservatives are all for the federal meddling when you got the magic drug exception, isn't it? So Jeff Sessions wants to increase this profit motive for policing. And this is a practice that has been abused time and time and time again in numerous reports we show. For example, since 2007, the DEA, just the DEA, just the federal forfeitures, not even including the state forfeitures, just the federal forfeitures have taken $3 billion with a B, $3 billion cash, not just assets, not just property and cars, $3 billion cash from people who have never been charged with a crime. Since 2007, the past decade, $3 billion in cash stolen from people who are supposedly innocent until proven guilty. In 2016, Oklahoma police seized $53,000 from a Christian band after stopping a man on a highway for a broken taillight. A few years earlier, a Michigan drug task force raided the home of a self-described soccer mom, suspecting she wasn't in compliance with the state medical marijuana law. They took every belonging from the family, including tools, bicycle, and her daughter's piggy bank birthday money. So this has been abused time and time again. We've seen cases of abuse in my old home state of Idaho, where a young man had $15,000 taken from him that he had withdrawn to be able to start a hip-hop career in California. He was headed to California, had the money for studio time. Cops just take that from him on the mere suspicion that there's some sort of drug activity going on. Now, like I mentioned, in 2015, former Attorney General Eric Holder issued a memo to curtail adoptive forfeiture to say, no, we're not going to take these cases from the states. If a state has decided that the cops shouldn't be able to just go steal people's money, the feds shouldn't jump in and provide relief for them. That's what Attorney General Sessions wants to overturn now. That's part of what he's doing in overturning this case, is making, or overturning that memo, is to make sure the cops can go get all the money they want to get after seizing it from us, the druggies. This is a federalism issue. It's about time that conservatives who say they believe in states' rights on other issues started applying that to the states that curtail forfeiture and legalize marijuana.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
That's all the time we got for our first hour. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for hour two. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
You take a seat, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down super.